Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm interviewing an Australian, Dave Sweeney, who's been active in the uranium mining and nuclear debate for two decades through his work with the media, trade unions in Australia, and environmental groups on mining, resource, and Indigenous issues. He currently works as a national nuclear campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation and holds a vision of a nuclear-free Australia that is positive about its future and honest about its past. Well, they're big asks, aren't they, Dave?
They are big asks, Helen, but they're important ones. They're long overdue ones in Australia, and they're ones that myself and many others are committed to and happy to work on.
Yeah. Why don't you, Dave Sweeney, give us some history for the listeners about the uranium deposits in Australia, when they were first discovered, when they were first mined, what they were first used for, coming up to the present time?
Yeah, well, Australia has the majority of the world's uranium resources. We have around 40% of the world's uranium reserves in this country. And there's been a long history with uranium mining, and it began with radium mining at a place called Radium Hill in South Australia. And radium was used, as it was elsewhere, for different industrial and medical applications. And then it was there was increasingly the knowledge of the ability of radium and uranium and related radioactive materials to the search that was going on to control the splitting of these for energy and also for weaponry. And Australia actually contributed uranium and other radioactive materials from deposits in South Australia and the Northern Territory to the British weapons program. So we've had from early days a connection between the civil and the military applications of this industry, Helen.
Yeah.
And in many ways, the development of the Australian domestic uranium industry mirrored that of the United States. It was secret during the wartime period. After the war, there was a sense of unbridled fear and unbridled optimism, those two weird things combining. And in the 1950s, there was a major effort by the Australian federal government to find and develop uranium reserves. There was subsidies and incentives and bonuses given to explorers and companies. There was a uranium bonanza, a new sort of gold rush, particularly in the Northern Territory region of Australia. And many former service personnel, drifters and sort of
hobos,
mercenaries, missionaries and misfits started looking for uranium, and there was a fledgling industry became increasingly established.
That was in the 50s and 60s.
Yes, and we're still paying the price for that now, actually. There was just there's a continuing rehabilitation and remediation program that's happening in Australia's largest national park. Many of your listeners might have heard of a park in the northern part of Australia called Kakadu National Park. It's one of Australia's largest national park, and it's a World Heritage listed area for both its natural and its cultural, its indigenous and its ecological features and properties. Well, all through that area, it's highly mineralised, Helen, and there was a extensive, often quite small, some large, but many small uranium deposits and operations through the 50s and 60s. And we're still today, as we approach the end of the first decade of the 21st century, have an active remediation program, and there's still regular allocations from the Commonwealth government to try and clean up the mess of that enthusiasm and excess that happened 50 years ago.
Oh, how do they remediate it, Dave? What do they actually do physically?
Basically, they do a set of works. One is non-radioactive. What they do is they fence off areas, they put up signage, they
to say this is radioactive?
And, yes, they put up signage saying, you know, do not enter, radioactive, do not stay here, do not camp here, do not swim or drink in this water, do not eat food from this area. They then do a series of things to try and divert rainwater, because this is a monsoonal region with high levels of rainwater. They try and divert rainwater away from the contaminated areas to reduce the contamination incident. And then they actually go and do the more difficult work, which is actually physically collecting, scraping, removing, digging residual radioactive material, mine tailings, etc., and reburying these either in a central pit at one of the former mine sites, or reburied pits at the smaller ones. Like, one of the problems, as your listeners will well know, is that this stuff can't be turned off when there's no longer a company interested in it, or when the price is no longer viable, or when the market falls. Once material is dug up and broken out of its geological cocoon, it becomes much more bioavailable. This material that had been quite inert in the earth is now broken up, extracted, crushed and pulverized, and it's ready to blow in the wind and move in the water. And that's a extremely long-term and serious problem here, as it is wherever uranium is mined.
Yes, I think it's the same in the United States too. In New Mexico and other areas, there is no remediation. What they could do is bury the mine tailings or the stuff that's left over that's very radioactive back in the hole, but they never do that. And if you include remediation in the whole life cycle of nuclear power, from mining all the way through to nuclear waste, if you include remediation, a huge amount of CO2 collectively is made in the whole life cycle. But, of course, there's never been remediation before. Why don't you, Dave, tell us about the myth of the rainbow snake, or the Dreamtime myth of the rainbow snake that the Aborigines have who live in Kakadu?
Well, there's a lot of connection between Indigenous Australians, Aboriginal Australians, and the uranium industry. Kakadu is one very clear place in point. And basically what we have is the intersection of the world's oldest continuing cultural practice. The oldest continuing culture on Earth is Australian Aboriginal culture. And that culture is profoundly shaped by a series of approaches and beliefs that are collectively captured by the term the dreaming. Sometimes the word dream time is used, but dreaming is sort of more preferred by many Aboriginal people because it captures the fact that it's still current, that there is a link to the past and to the present, and indeed to the future in their view of how the world was created and how it has shape and meaning. In Kakadu, one of the most potent and powerful of the creation spirits was the rainbow serpent. And as the rainbow serpent moved through the countryside, the movement of that serpent formed the major natural features of the country as we now know it. It pushed land up to form the massive sandstone escarpment that is a key feature of Kakadu. It made the depressions that are the key East Alligator and South Alligator rivers, the driving rivers of the massive Kakadu wetlands. And all of these creation figures remain in the environment. They remain almost in like a hibernating or dormant stage, but they remain in the environment. There are a whole system of laws and a whole system of protocols about what is and isn't done in order to ensure that these creation figures are not disturbed, annoyed, or damaged. And that ties in very much with concepts of sacred sites, of special areas, of sickness country, which is country that you don't go to where there is an increased likelihood of something bad happening as a result of being in that area.
Like uranium country.
Yeah, there's often a linkage between where uranium deposits are found and sickness country or sacred sites, a higher incidence of sacred sites. And you know, like, there is a strong and continuing connection between Aboriginal people, their desire to see short-term and long-term protection of their country and their estate, Helen,
yes.
And their concerns about this industry. Indigenous people in Australia, as they have been in the US and as they have been around the world, have been and continue to be at the forefront of the adverse burden of this industry.
Mm.
In Australia, that's taken the form of being displaced in order to allow access to uranium mining.
Mm.
It's having their opposition to uranium projects directly circumvented and overruled. And it's also been by the very real and experience and the continuing legacy of Aboriginal people in this country having their homeland turned into rocket testing ranges and nuclear weapons testing ranges.
Yes. Doesn't the myth or Dreamtime of the Rainbow Snake 2, Dave Sweeney, say that if the rainbow snake is disturbed, it will devour the world?
There is that.
Is kind of prophetic, isn't it, as nuclear weapons are made from uranium?
Well, absolutely. It's very interesting because, like, the rainbow snake, that is the myth. The rainbow snake is disturbed and angered. The circumstances that keep the rainbow snake serpent in balance are disturbed, then that snake will bring cataclysmic destruction upon the earth. There's also a project that's now being proposed. Helen, it's just been announced and in the last 10 days by the world's biggest mining company, which originated in Australia, BHP Billiton, for a mining deposit at a place called Yeelirrie in Western Australia. And it's one of a whole series of new proposals, but we've recently been contacted by some Aboriginal people in that area who have said that Yeelirrie in their language means place of death.
Mm.
So, you know, in the same way as you see all of these, so often there's these resonances of old knowledge and new threats, and we certainly see it here in Australia. And, you know, there's whether your reason or your concern or what motivates you or empowers you to take a position against this industry is from one of respecting the oldest cultural practice on earth, or whether it's from one of just the self-interest of seeing that if we continue to dig out this material, we continue to have a growing threat from weapons or waste. I suppose it doesn't matter what the motivation is. It's bringing people to that place of saying this is an industry that is unlike any other industry. I think what's important to remember in the Australian context, Helen, is that this country, after white settlement, after white people came here, which is only very recent, it's only 220 years, since that time, the resource economy has been very important in Australia.
What are resources? What's the definition?
Well, predominantly, the mineral resources of this country have been really pivotal in developing the economic base of Australia. Gold has been pivotal. Coal, iron ore, and more recently, there is a push to make uranium one of the new platforms, one of the new bases of Australian resource wealth into the 21st century. There's all this talk from industry promoters saying that Australia will be the Saudi Arabia of the nuclear age. What I'm saying, though, is that there's been quite a utilitarian, quite a functional, quite a get-in, extract-it and get-out approach to the landscape and the landform and the environment in Australia. We've had, exotic animals in farming. We've had short-term usage of native forests with logging and clearing at extraordinarily unsustainable rates. And we've had an aggressive mineral resource sector, which has also shaped the politics of this country and has an enormous amount of institutional power in the ear of government, in the ear of media in this country. There's that whole issue of the role of mining and that debate about whether or not we should be going there is one that's very important in Australia at the moment in the debate over uranium mining, because uranium is unlike any other mineral. It is linked to the proliferation of the worst weapons in the world, and it is intimately and inextricably linked to the production of some of the worst industrial waste in the world. So one of the things that environment groups and many others in Australia are trying to do into the debate at the moment, Helen, is say, look, I know we've had a lot of mining in this country over many years, but this mining is different from anything we've had. Mm. It has unique properties, unique risks, and it needs to be seriously debated.
Which it's not being. And also, Dave Sweeney, the history of uranium mining recently in this country is interesting, because the unions, and we had a very powerful union movement in the 70s, decided collectively that they would neither mine, transport nor export uranium. And that ban, that veto, lasted 5 years. But then somehow the mining corporations got involved with the politicians and with the public relations, and now they've taken over, and the unions also are not as strong as they used to be, right?
Yeah, well, many unions maintain strong positions. Some don't. Some are in favour of uranium mining and export. They're definitely a minority of Australian organised labour that supports this industry. The majority is opposed to it.
Yeah.
But you're right, though, like, because one of the things that's changed in 40 years has been the role of industrial labour and the amount of power that industrial labour can bring. Things have been increasingly deregulated in Australia. I'm sure it's the same in the States. There has been a drop in the number of people in organised trade unions, a drop in membership, a drop in power, and probably to some degree a drop in their ability to directly exercise political influence. They're still a very powerful force, and they're often a very progressive and important force, but they're not as strong as they were perhaps 30 years ago.
That's
and
right.
And that's the case here in Australia. We are very happy to see that the majority and some very powerful unions, including construction unions, metal engineering unions, the maritime union, and many other unions, including a whole range of the unions in the education and health sectors, are strongly opposed to uranium mining and export, and also strongly opposed to a whole range of other concerns like irresponsible radioactive waste management or the discussion of domestic nuclear power in Australia.
Yes, but that concern needs to be collectively mobilised so that we can actually stop uranium mining. And at the moment, I there are several things I want to address, Dave Sweeney. Incidentally, I'm interviewing Dave Sweeney, who is the National Nuclear Campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation, a very well-informed person on the whole issue of uranium mining in Australia. I want to talk about Roxby, or in other words, Olympic Dam, which is now and will be the biggest uranium mine in the whole world, and the size of it and what it means. And I also would like to talk about the nuclear weapons testing that Britain conducted at Maralinga and at Christmas at Montebello in the 60s and early 70s, and what that meant to the Aboriginal and Indigenous populations. Which one would you like to address first, Dave Sweeney?
Well, let's start with the world's biggest miner and the proposed world's biggest mine.
Right.
Roxby Downs, or Olympic Dam, is a huge uranium deposit. It's in northern South Australia, about 500 kilometres north of Adelaide.
And I want you all to get out your atlases and maps and look at the areas of Australia that Dave Sweeney is describing now. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a very large uranium deposit. It's estimated to be the world's largest deposit. It's currently an underground mine, which is run by BHP Billiton and extracts, processes, exports around 5,000 tonnes of uranium a year. The company want to greatly increase that. They have now an active environmental application and approvals process in train to turn that underground project into a massive open cut project with an open cut mine that would be visible from space that would triple uranium production and export, so anywhere around 15,000 tonnes a year from that single mine.
And how large would the mine be in terms of miles, depth, width?
Everything about it is quite huge. It's about 1.5 kilometres deep. I think it's 3.5 long. I think the amount of ore, the overburden, the dirt that they have to remove in order to get to that depth and to do this to this mine is 4 years, 24 hours a day, extracting that overburden for 4 years. So you get a sense of the size of this project. It would be also producing anywhere between 15 and 35 million tonnes of uranium tailings a year.
And what about the CO2 emissions from removing the overburden?
CO2 emissions from removing the overburden are extensive. Water consumption is huge. The project would take a huge proportion of the state electricity production. So, by every yardstick, Helen, this is a very major project by the world's biggest mining company, and what it is also doing, like the company is considering all sorts of different add-ons, like the potential of all the ore going out on the rail line out through Darwin, which is massive distances of transport. The ore going out, instead of being processed in Australia, vast amounts of copper going out as a copper concentrate for further processing in China. And that copper concentrate would also include significant volumes of uranium, which would be recovered in that concentrating process. So there's a proliferation risk as well as a radiation and OH&S, occupational health and safety risk, involved with that. So what we have is the world's biggest miner with the world's biggest uranium deposit wanting to move it into the world's biggest uranium mine with a very severe set of impacts locally in relation to energy, carbon, water, and nationally in relation to what this means for the institutional bias of decision-making about resource extraction in this country, and internationally in relation to the fact that this project would be fueling massive regional uncertainty, particularly through its sales to China.
And at this stage, Dave Sweeney, who does Australia sell its uranium to? Which countries?
Well, we sell our uranium, a lot goes to the States, to the US.
For what reason?
All of it is to nuclear utilities for electric power generation. We sell to the US, we sell to South Korea and to Japan. That sort of North Asia, South Korea, Japan is a significant market. We sell to Western Europe as well. We sell to France, We sell to the UK. We sell to a number of other nations in the EU.
China.
We have just started sales to China. We have had one shipment to China, but there is a very strong push within the Australian mining industry and within the Australian federal government to significantly expand sales to China. There is a lot of crossover. There is increasing crossover on trade and nuclear cooperation arrangements with China, and there is increasing integration of Chinese capital into Australian mining projects. Chinese utilities and Chinese companies are spending up large in Australia to buy into resource projects, and a preferred sector for them is the uranium sector.
It's terribly scary.
So it's certainly, China is a very strong push for that. The others too that listeners might be interested to know that are two markets that the Australian uranium industry is pushing aggressively for, but they're still in contest. One is India, where there is a very strong push from the industry to sell uranium to India, and India has made it very clear that it very much wants to purchase Australian uranium, and the block there, the impediment there, is the fact that India is not a signatory to the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the policy of the current federal Labor government is that there will be no uranium sales to non-NPT countries. Now, that is a sort of concession that they've made to concerns within their own party ranks about the issue of nuclear proliferation. The way they attempt to address that is to say that we'll ensure that the NPT is strengthened, and we'll do that by not selling to any country that's not a signatory. Now, India isn't a signatory. India isn't likely to become a signatory. It's made that very clear.
Mm.
And there is growing pressure in Australia now to say, look, the US and India have made a bilateral special understanding on nuclear issues. Surely times have changed. Surely now it's time to start selling uranium to India. And indeed, as we speak, shortly before we've started speaking today, Helen, I've been reading a piece by a leading conservative commentator in the Australian media saying that the Australian refusal to sell uranium to India is nothing more than apartheid. So we can see the strength of the push to sell to India. The other country that there's a lot of push on is Russia.
Mm.
The former Australian federal government, Prime Minister John Howard, signed a deal with Vladimir Putin, and when they were out here, when Putin was in Sydney, in Australia, in Sydney a few years ago for an APEC meeting, Asia Pacific Environment or Economic Council, they signed an agreement, a framework agreement for the supply of Australian uranium to Russia. That was reviewed when the new federal government came into power. There was a parliamentary committee that looked at that. Environment groups, health groups, international relations groups, human rights and civil society groups made very strong recommendations and presentations to that committee process. And we were very surprised and, well, pleased, because for the first time in a long time there was a committee that actually seemed to listen rather than just follow its preordained writing instructions. And that committee said, look, there are real concerns about selling uranium to Russia at this point in time, with Russia's lack of protections for civil society, with the lack of international safeguards and assurances about the security of the Russian nuclear industry, and a range of other concerns, and we need to see these addressed before we sell uranium to Russia. And that's a big push on at the moment.
Yes.
Some people are saying we never should. Others are saying it's a new market and we would be crazy not to.
Well, Dave Sweeney, do you think that Prime Minister Kevin Rudd and members of the Labor Party currently in federal government understand what uranium mining and export really means? In other words, that the leakage and seepage of radioactive waste, thousands, hundreds of thousands of tons over centuries, what that will mean to the public health of the people of the world in terms of cancer production, genetic disease, and proliferation of nuclear weapons. Do you think they're really aware of what the dangers are?
No. The short answer is no, I don't. I don't believe they are, and I believe if they were, I don't believe that any person who knew those could persist with this industry and expand this industry. I think you would be on a fast track to phase it out and get rid of it. So I don't believe that they are fully aware of the implications of this trade at all. I believe that they are briefed by people who deal with figures that are in neat reports about gigawatt hours and how France is 78% dependent on nuclear energy, and they have a sanitised view that it's somehow clean and controllable, and these wastes can be put into shiny canisters and put away somewhere and it'll be okay.
But how can they be so profoundly ignorant, Dave?
Well, it seems almost a comprehensive institutional denial happening here, Helen. And it's absolutely the case in relation to the fact that we can guarantee that every gram of Australian uranium will become radioactive waste, but we can't guarantee that not one gram will become nuclear weapon. The denial by policymakers and decision makers and industry on these issues is incredible, and it's particularly clear when it comes to the weapons link.
Mm.
In Australia of late, I imagine it's the same in the US. Our headlines have been dominated by a new round of weapons testing by North Korea, increasing concerns and tension between India and Pakistan.
Mm.
And it's all the N-word, nuclear, is regularly and routinely there.
Mm.
And it is quite a bizarre disconnection. I find it very difficult to explain the disconnection between a political leader who can stand there and talk about deep concern for nuclear proliferation, terrorism, and weapons, and then turn around and speak to another audience and say that their government is committed to maximising Australian uranium export.
Yes, it's totally irrational, isn't it? Irrational behaviour.
It is quite irrational. Like, well, you know, you're the physician, Helen. You might be the one with the better analysis of that. All I do is I see it, and I am constantly amazed at how people are not making the connections between that this mineral becomes a high-level long-term waste and this mineral fuels the world's worst weapons. The other thing about it is that, as we know, electrical power generated through the nuclear industry, it's a byproduct, a short-term byproduct of the long-term creation of radioactive waste.
Mm.
Because the hot showers, the cold beers, the energy services that people will get today from Australian uranium will be being paid for in human and health and ecological terms for another 200,000 plus years. And it's just such an extraordinarily poor deal. The other point, which is such a source of frustration and lost opportunity and under-realised potential that we face in Australia, is that Australia has vast renewable resources. We have enormous and high-quality solar assets, wind assets. We have a range of geothermal options. We have a range of bioenergy options. We have all of these options where we could be and should be a world leader in the smart generation and efficient use of power. And instead, we are increasingly locking ourselves into being a quarry economy. We are the biggest exporter of coal.
In the world.
We
yep.
are the second biggest exporter of uranium. And we are on a fast track to become the biggest if the government and the industry gets its way. And instead of addressing climate change, the challenge of climate change, in a way that provides regional employment, regional and international security, and in a way that means that we have clean, safe and sustainable energy systems, We are trying to dig our way out of climate change with more coal and more uranium, and we are, as a country, digging ourselves into a hole, and as a country, failing to show the leadership that we need to and play the role that we could and should be playing in the world community.
Why do you think this is happening? Why are our politicians so stupid, Dave Sweeney?
I think it's a combination of institutional bias.
Bias towards what? What do you mean, bias?
Well, we have massive profits being generated by corporations who are doing very well out of the current system. Our coal miners are turning a lot of money. Our uranium miners are making profit. All of the spin doctors and the publicists and the lobbyists and that they employ to protect and extend their position are doing very nicely. There's a lot of people doing very nicely at a very dirty trade.
So why is the media supporting it?
Well, that's a more difficult question. Well, Australia has one of the most concentrated, if not the most concentrated, media ownership of any Western democratic country. We're only a small country. We've only got 21 million people, so we're not a big country. Like if you look at the states of 10 times more than 10 times that population. Mm-hmm. So it's not a big market. It is a very controlled market. It is a very concentrated ownership.
Who owns it, most of it?
Well, Rupert Murdoch owns a lot.
Yep.
And we face a problem where a small group of the commentariat, a small group of editors and senior commentators, influence what a very large group of people, they might influence what they think. They certainly influence what they think about. There's many, many important stories about the uranium sector, its deficiencies, its environmental impacts, its opposition from Indigenous people. They're really worthy stories. They are newsworthy stories. They are gutsy stories. And they never make the middle page, let alone the front page of the Australian press. And there's a real problem there because the problem has been heightened by the fact now that both of the major federal political parties, the Conservative Party and the somewhat less conservative Labor Party, both the federal parties that constitute government at different times in this country, now have policy positions that support uranium mining and export. So for many in industry, they have been able to successfully say to people in the media, uranium mining is not an issue anymore. Both sides agree with it. It's not an argument. That's not the case. It's a highly contested, highly controversial industry. But there are serious institutional power barriers. But the other problem here is that Australia is a very large country. Mm. Helen, you're well aware of that. You've travelled it and spoken all around
it's
the place.
It's as large as the US in area.
It's as big as the US with 1/15th of its people.
Yeah.
And where the mining happens is really a long way from where most people live.
Yeah.
It is not in people's backyard.
No.
And we don't have domestic nuclear power here.
Yeah.
And so there's not that as a rallying cry, which it often is in the States. People can make that connection. They don't want a reactor in their area. And then they think, well, where does that fuel come from that fuels that reactor? Here we don't have the reactor.
Mm.
And so we have the mines. We're very much the front end, at least at this stage, the front end of the nuclear cycle. We dig the stuff up, shovel it onto boats and get it out of here.
Yeah.
So it becomes a problem somewhere else.
Yep.
And a lot of people, Helen, they don't see it.
No.
And if they don't actually see it, they find it difficult to conceptualise just how damaging it is and just how much we need to turn the tap off.
Oh, yeah. Well, now let's get on to the railway line between Adelaide and Darwin. If you look at your maps, everyone, Adelaide is in the southeast of Australia, right at the bottom nearly, and Darwin is right at the top. Who built the railway line? What was it built for? And I want you to talk about GNEP, Dave Sweeney, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. So let's start with the railway line.
Yeah, well, there was a railway line for a long time between Adelaide and Alice Springs, between the central southern part of Australia and the red centre of Australia. And it stopped there. And there was that's roughly about 1,400 kilometres between Adelaide and Alice
Springs. Why is it called the red centre?
because it's
red.
It's red. It's desert. It's desert. It's a fantastically beautiful part of the country, as you well know. You know it well.
Yeah.
But it's on one side, on both sides, there's these large mountains, McDonald Ranges, and then once you move out of the lee of the ranges, you move into much more either swale, soft sand dune, or open desert plain country. You know, and it's very beautiful country, and it's for many in their picture of Australia, it's Australia's either the beach or that red sand of central Australia.
Yeah.
But the train line used to stop at Alice Springs, and for a long time that's as far as it went. And there'd been talk for decades about let's expand it up to Darwin, and then it was done. The decision was made, and it was done. And it was some big names involved in the construction, including Halliburton and Serco.
Related to Halliburton?
Well, related to, well, senior figures in the former USM.
Name them. Name
Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton before he became vice president, but also Serco is the organisation, I think, that is responsible for radioactive waste storage in Britain. Is that so?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. It's certainly involved in radioactive waste transport, and I'm pretty sure that they're involved in the storage as well.
Yeah.
So they pushed forward a line and took it another 1,300 or 1,400 kilometres further up the track to link, for the first time, Australia from north to south by rail.
Yes.
What we have now is a central corridor that you know, a lot of people retire and take an expensive but lovely train trip up and see some fantastic country, meet some interesting people and have dinner. There's a lot of freight that goes up there. Some of it is fine. Increasingly, a lot of that freight is less fine. A lot of that freight is radioactive material. A lot of that freight and what that line is doing is opening up a lot more industrial development and mining development right through the central corridor of Australia. And that will hardly be surprising to anyone who's ever studied the map, or like if you look at the US experience, you know, the Iron Railroad went in first and then whole areas of country were opened up to all sorts of development, good, bad or indifferent. And the same's happening in that area now. We're seeing lots of mining projects that without that rail line, they would not have been advanced because transport would have been too difficult, now opening up. But the big one that's of concern to groups like the Australian Conservation Foundation, also concern to many Indigenous groups, is that the line is increasingly being used as the centre point of major uranium expansion in Australia. There's only two ports in Australia, Helen, one in the south at Adelaide and one in the north at Darwin. They're the only two ports in Australia that have the capacity and the regulatory approvals to export uranium.
Yeah.
And there's an increasing push by the industry to centralise all of that on the port of Darwin because it's further north and closer to where we export to.
Mm.
And that rail line is increasingly becoming a funnel for uranium heading out. And the concern is, will it also be like the Boomerang brand, that very famous object designed in Australia that you throw and it circles and it comes back to you? Will what we send out as uranium ore then come back to us further down the track as the world's high-level waste and go down that same railway to a global dump somewhere in central Australia or somewhere else? That's the question that a lot of people are asking themselves, and there's a lot of secrecy around that at the moment.
There is, and I know that our former Prime Minister John Howard signed an agreement called the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership with George Bush and his administration. What does that actually say, Dave? A, and B, when the new government, the Labor government, got into power about a year ago, they said that they would veto that Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. What does it mean and why haven't they?
Yeah, well, the GNEP is basically an initiative that's aimed at expanding the nuclear industry internationally, at concentrating where there will be, it uses that language of making a nuclear industry expansion proliferation proof, and they do that by concentrating where those most proliferation-sensitive industries and technologies are, particularly uranium enrichment. That's part of the deal. So the world gets reactors and nuclear power. They don't get enrichment. That stays the preserve of the US and a number of other countries. And that there basically becomes a refashioned 21st century nuclear club under pretty much under US stewardship. Australia's role in that would be to be the uranium supplier. That's how Australia saw its role. That's how Australia's role was spoken of when John Howard met George Bush to talk up the deal and to sign the deal without any agreement in Australia or any notice or debate in Australia. But we were seen as the responsible supplier, the supplier that was politically stable, the supplier that had, you know, reasonable occupational health and safety standards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The supplier that was reasonably non-corrupt, the reliable provider. One of the other concerns, though, is that GNEP is also about closing the cycle, and it's also using words like fuel leasing, nuclear stewardship, and other phrases like that, Helen, which are often code for the stuff comes back. And there's a strong concern that under GNEP, as the idea advances either in the GNEP forum or in another way, that we will become, Australia, will become the world's preeminent uranium provider and the world's major uranium or nuclear waste recipient.
Including probably some of America's radioactive waste.
Well, particularly given the recent developments in the US with the Obama administration, putting the brakes on Yucca Mountain development, and congratulations to them for that. Long overdue and very welcome, but it also leaves the US industry with a major problem, even bigger than the problem that it already has, and that is what do we do with our waste? How can we clear some of this stuff off existing reactor sites in order to meet licensing or license extension conditions? These will all be real issues and pressures. So the Labor government came to power in late 2007, and it had a policy that it would remove Australia from involvement in GNEP.
Yep.
And it was we had meetings with them and had that confirmed shortly after they took office.
Mm.
And in the period between late 2007 and middle 2009, when we speak now, that position has just, like many positions do in government, it's been eroded. And Australian representatives and Australian diplomats are still involved in senior levels of the GNEP initiative. We attend every meeting of the initiative.
Do we?
And there has been no movement at all about rescinding the agreement. In fact, the opposite is the case. So how that's happened, I'm not sure. I could hazard a guess that the incoming Labor government is instructed on the real world politics of GNEP and the importance of being in this forum in order to maintain a growing market share of a valuable mineral export,
et
cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
There would also be, no doubt, there would have been people courted. Our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, which is our State Department, would have been courted by all sorts of people saying that GNEP is the best way, the most mature, the most responsible way to advance nuclear non-proliferation outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. And through either naivety or gullibility or capriciousness, they've fallen for this and they continue to engage in it. So that has been and continues to be a real disappointment for us and a real concern for us. And it's one of a whole range of nuclear issues which has the red light flashing on the desk, Helen. There's pressure here for expanded uranium operations at the existing operating mines. There's pressure for new uranium mines in many different parts of the country. There's continuing engagement with GNEP and a range of international initiatives. There is continuing engagement in support for US and other nuclear military umbrellas and activities. There is continuing unresolved issue about domestic nuclear waste and the search by an aggressive federal minister to try and find a place to impose a federal radioactive waste dump. And there's unresolved concerns about where we are positioning, where we are heading, where we are allowing ourselves to be headed in relation to international radioactive waste. So there's a range of red lights that are flashing and urging caution and demanding attention about nuclear issues in Australia right now.
Well, we could be called Australia the nuclear nation.
Well, there's some who would welcome that. There's some who are
unbelievable.
There's some who are very strongly arguing and increasingly confident to argue it in public. It was sort of like an issue that was once quietly canvassed between members of the bizarre and scrutinised inner circle cult. Now it's increasingly people are feeling confident to advance it in public that we should embrace nuclear, we should have domestic nuclear power, and we should not sell Australian uranium. We should dig it up here, process it here, enrich it and fabricate it here, ship it out as fuel rods and bring it back as spent fuel. We should do the whole cycle and carve off a part of desert in Western Australia, South Australia, the Northern Territory, somewhere, make it a secure zone, and the rest of us live on the East Coast on the royalties and on the rental profits. And people are putting forward that idea. So there is a real and alive contest of ideas in Australia at the moment. And this issue, as you well know, Helen, you've played a really important role in the Australian debate over uranium mining, over radioactive waste management, over the US nuclear umbrella, the weapons umbrella, and what that means for Australia. You're well aware that there remains a very, very strong strand of concern, which crosses. It crosses gender, it crosses class, it crosses political orientation. There's a very strong strand of concern. There's a very strong desire amongst many in Australia to have the courage and the clarity to be like the crew in New Zealand and to declare that this part of the planet is not going down the path of nuclear madness. We're stepping clear and we're being nuclear free. Now, that part of the Australian community now is engaged in a real contest of ideas, not with an Australian community that's demanding that we go nuclear, but with some very influential opinion shapers, politicians, and some industry people.
Cashed up is the word. Well, it's either money that will determine the fate of the earth, really, or morality. So it's kind of, where do we go from here?
Well, I think it's pretty clear from us where we're going. We have got a strong focus on supporting that large section of the community that says no, and in the first instance, providing them with the time and the tools to engage in this debate, and then to take this debate, which isn't being held. Like there's not a national debate, there's not a national referendum, there's not politicians seeking opinions, there's politicians telling us what our opinion has now changed to. So we're trying to turn it from a false market research, media-managed set of encounters into a real public discourse and debate. And we're also, the other thing that we're working very hard to do, you mentioned earlier the role of trade unions. We're working with unions and worker representative bodies to look at what are the actual impact, to try and track some of the impacts of this trade. But we're particularly putting a lot of effort into working with those who are most directly affected, which is First Nation people, Australian Aboriginal people.
Yes, Dave.
There's a very interesting alliance happening at the moment now called the Australian Nuclear Free Alliance, Helen.
Yes.
And it's an alliance between public health bodies, between environment groups and a whole range of Indigenous groups. And industry sees it as a major impediment, and they're spending a lot of money on DVD saying that uranium's all okay.
Mm.
Government sees it as an impediment and is fast-tracking a whole range of laws that cut out Indigenous people's rights to say no.
Mm.
But there's a lot, the feedback we're getting from a lot of Indigenous people on the ground is that sense of, if you like, environmentalists and public health allies and activists in the cities, and Aboriginal people on the ground in the country. It's not as cut and dried as that, but broadly is a really powerful force, one they welcome and one that we want to see grow because, like you've said, it is a major time of choice and it's the time to we sit back and accept our country, which is, you know, one where I was born. I've got a lot of time and I love and spend a lot of time out in the bush. Do we accept that this country becomes a quarry and a dump? Or do we stand up, engage, and as citizens, put our hand on the wheel and try and steer it to a saner path?
Well, Dave Sweeney, it's been wonderful to interview you. I have to tell the listening audience that Dave is one of the major thinkers in this area in Australia and one of the major, shall I say, activists who is going to have, I hope in the future, a profound impact upon the way Australia proceeds in the nuclear area. So I want to thank you very much, Dave Sweeney, for this interview and hope that everyone listening now understands the impact of Australian uranium mining and what it could mean to the future of the planet.
Helen, thanks very much for the opportunity. I've loved talking with you today and for your work in the past, right now, and I'm sure into the future for doing the same, and thanks so much for your show and the opportunity to be on it.
Well, that's a pleasure, and in fact, we will interview you again in the future in the months ahead to follow the debate and what is happening in Australia. Thanks, Dave.
Look forward to it. All the best, Helen.
I've just been interviewing Dave Sweeney, who's been active in the uranium mining and nuclear debates in Australia for 2 decades, working with the media, trade unions, environmental groups on mining, resource and Indigenous issues. He is the National Nuclear Campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation. And if you want to contact the Australian Foundation, go to acfonline.org.au. Thank you so much for listening this time to If You Love This Planet. Don't forget, if you'd like to support us, you can go to the webpage ifyoulovethisplanet.org. And there is a place where you can make donations, which would be very gratefully accepted. I thank my producer in Australia, Jasmine Williams, my producer in America, Scott Powell, and my outreach coordinator, Amanda Bellaby. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.